sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
I was a hardcore kind of like sales leader by the MQLs until like mid 2018. If April 2018, Jake heard this, Jake, he'd like punch him in the face. He'd be like, dude, brand, that's the arts and crafts. But now look, I've done it for my business. We're closing millions of dollars of organic LinkedIn ads, spending zero. And I think B2B is boring, dude, boring. I think brand is ready for a comeback. And so that goes back to what you can't measure does matter. And I think the answer is both.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. Now, that was Jake Dunlap. Jake's the CEO of Scale. And in this episode, Jake and I are talking about an article that he posted on LinkedIn a few months ago about five predominant myths that we find in sales. Now, you really want to listen to this conversation because I think it's safe to say that, well, I had a few issues with Jake's myths. And however, I really enjoyed sparring with Jake because this is the type of open, honest discussion that needs to happen more frequently in sales. Because quite honestly, B2B sales is in a bit of a mess. And there are a lot of issues that need to be addressed. And it's only by engaging in these types of open, honest conversations we'll be able to start moving the ball forward. So I really enjoyed Jake joining me for this. So stick around, check it out. Now, before we get to Jake, I want to remind you, though, to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could also give us your feedback about how we're doing in the form of a review. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it. Jake, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here. New home. New home, same you. I love it.
New home, same me. Some people are probably wishing for a new me, but they got the same me.
Nah.
So... you've got a new home. You moved from New York City to Austin, Texas since the last time we spoke.
Wow. It's been that long. Yes, that is correct. It's been almost 2 years now.
Wow.
It's been great. We're loving it.
So why?
For us, look, as you're scaling a business and, you know, we're not a venture-backed business, mm-hmm. There's easier places to do it than Soho. New York. Yeah, I love New York. And you know, I was going back every 3 to 4 weeks. I kind of had the best of both worlds until COVID hit.
Doing bi-coastal to land. Yeah,
exactly. So it's kind of nice. So I still love New York. I don't know. I'm trying to talk my wife that, hey, if there's some point, maybe we'll be back at some point. But no, Austin's great. Amazing tech scene. Great culture. Just it's an awesome, awesome place. And now I feel like everyone, I mean, the amount of the New York and California people coming to Austin is just amazing. So I'm loving it.
Yeah. Until the traffic comes to a complete stop and the property prices catch up with every place else. Yeah.
That's all right. We got in earlier. Earlier.
Yes. Or like Seattle at one point was that destination. Yeah. Let's go up Seattle.
Right. Exactly.
Then California people ruined that too, I think. So
I think a lot of people are worried about that same thing.
I'm sure. I mean, there was this was like in the early 90s when there was sort of this outward migration from California to Oregon. And there was this famous bumper sticker that they had in Oregon is, "Don't Californicate Oregon."
I've already seen him here.
Oh, you have? All right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think the last time I flew from San Diego to Austin, I talked to two people on the flight that were recent transfers to Austin. So, yeah, it's happening. So, but one of them was commuting. One didn't move. One was commuting. Wow. So, yeah. I wouldn't want to do that.
No,
so, you talked about the pandemic. And the question I'm asking all my guests these days is, what was the biggest lesson, or what is the biggest lesson you've learned about yourself during the pandemic?
About me? Yeah. I think that one of the big takeaways is, and maybe a lot of sales leaders had this, but I can speak for myself. I feel like sales has always been kind of a culture where, you know, it's like, you got to be in the office and the energy's we need to be there. We got to be putting our thumb on these people. And we were already about probably 50, 60% remote. So mm-hmm. culturally, but I think what I was able to observe and what I learned is that, you know, people are pretty self-sufficient. You know, if they have clear goals, they can go hit them. So I think the mindset shift away from that an office is necessary to maintain culture, to have fun, to be engaged, to do hard, amazing work is maybe a little untrue, you know, and that there's certainly benefits to face-to-face. And, you know, we've done a few small things here or there, but I think I've just been amazed at the resiliency of others. And that's really reflected on me and being, you know, how I think even about going forward and building my company.
Yeah. So I think there's danger though, that a lot of leaders are extrapolating to the long term based on a very small sample size. And, you know, it's one thing that when people are forced to work remotely, but I've been reading more and more stuff about this and surveys of CEOs. There's a two-part thing. I think it was Wall Street Journal last week interviewing CEOs about this. And a fairly broad consensus that, yeah, maybe not everybody's coming back, but we are coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 50%, 60%. Yeah, it was oftentimes mm-hmm. sort of the number used. And I think that sounds about right.
I do too. Yeah, I mean, look at what Yahoo did, right? It was Melissa, right? Melissa Mayer, who Yahoo had went to 100% remote call, I believe. Yeah. And again, I could be kind of misquoting slightly.
Well, roughly, and then she called them back. Yeah.
Yeah, and she's like, this isn't working. So we've already seen a big tech company that tried to do it and then realized like, whoa, productivity, et cetera, actually slipped. So I think that's right. I think the new normal is going to be some hybrid approach, you know, where you're in the office for certain days, for certain meetings, you're working from home when it makes sense. It's less of a stigma. I think maybe that's what it's done.
Yeah.
It's kind of removed the stigma from it and the ability of like, if someone's working from home, they're actually, you know, sipping a margarita at 10:30
playing golf,
hanging by the pool. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, morning drinking. Well, that's an idea. I never thought about that. that could be a new habit to start.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, my new habit was eating all the things my wife baked during shutdown. So,
well, alcohol sales are up 26% during COVID. So
yeah.
I think a lot more people are doing that.
Yeah. Well, I may have to go to Betty Ford for my sourdough addiction, but.
well, that's it. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. I definitely gained the COVID-19. So, anyway, working on that. All right. Well, I want to talk about something you'd posted not that long ago on LinkedIn about 5 sales myths. And I just want to run through those because I thought there was a lot of interesting fodder for discussion there.
Great.
You remember that article?
I do, for sure.
Okay. All right. So, your first myth was the myth is that sales isn't a science. So let me ask you the question. Why do you think sales is a science?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'll tell a little bit of story of how I arrived here. For me, I had done sales in college, came out of sales, worked in professional sports for 2.5 years in sales. I was very successful, top 1 or 2 in both teams that I work for.
Selling tickets
and then moving up into sponsorships and big premium seat deals. So, I moved up the Tampa Bay Rays, and by the way, this is not the current Tampa Bay Rays. Okay, this is the 2003, 2004, 2005 Tampa Bay Rays, which were the worst in baseball.
Right.
And then the Phoenix Coyotes win 2005, 2006.
And you did this all remote from New York?
No. I live there.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah. Right. I grew up in Kansas City. Go Chiefs, for those who don't know. And then moved to Tampa, then Phoenix for 5 years, San Francisco for 2.5, New York for 6.
Got
so I'm originally a Kansas City person. So So what I realized, I went to a career builder, right, in Phoenix. So I left, I got out of sports, and it was like, let maybe think about something different. And I was in my training class. I was the second to last person. I hadn't sold anything, right? And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm Jake Dunlap. I'm God's gift to sales. How have I not sold anything? I can't believe this. And I went to my director, and my director goes, dude, why aren't you reading the script and following the process? I'm like, Evan, I'm Jake Dunlap. I'm an amazing seller. And he goes, dude, do you think we train 1,000 people on this process because it doesn't work? And it was like a light bulb. The light bulb didn't go off. It like exploded in my head. I'm like, huh, well, probably not. He goes, exactly. He's like, dude, just trust me that we've laid out this process in a way that is optimized and and that you'll be able to put your own spin on it, et cetera. And then I closed 60,000 in new business the next month. And it was like, oh my gosh, wait. So there is a right and a wrong way to move people. There's a right way to start a meeting. There's a right order of operations of questions. There's a right way to talk about the product in a way that's, issue then solution based. There's a right way to put together a proposal. And if you couple that's more of like the tactical, like steps in the process. You couple that with the science of psychology, that the way that you phrase things, the subtleties of a pause, when I bring my voice down here, how you tend to lean in. And whenever I talk louder, you tend to. So there's not just a science in terms of the process that you move people through. There's also the science of people. And sometimes we think it's all art and made up. Well, it's really not. These are all, people are just executing psychological principles, or they're executing components of a good discovery. Just, what is that? Unconsciously competent.
Yeah. I mean, so I sort of look at the science a little bit differently. Cause I mean, sure, we've got processes. We know that they work to a certain point, right? We know that if we do this, we get a certain result out of it.
That's right. And let me just clarify, Andy, because I do want to clarify. The art is the difference between a B and an A player. I can build an army of B players if they're coachable. And that is the difference. But the people who believe it's pure art is bullshit. That it's not. Like there are things that you are doing, whether you realize it or not, that are based on best practices, that are based on human nature, that are based on other elements. So I just want to add that caveat, because it is true. There is an art element for sure. But don't get it twisted. The art, making it all art, is BS. It's just what separates elite from good.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. It's a mix. I'm not sure I know where that dividing line is, quite frankly. Because, we tend to, let's say take our data that we get from looking at our conversion rates and so on. And there's so much missing context in the data that we draw an obvious lesson from it. But, in the case of your script, let's say, with that you're using, sure, it worked a certain percentage of the time, but maybe a better one would have worked twice as much with better science, right?
Absolutely.
And so there's an assumption when we say science that somehow it's optimized. And I think one of the things we're really missing in a true science thing, and also the psychological, behavioral economics and so on, is those things work a part of the time, right? I mean, they're not, when they did the studies of, let's take loss aversion, being one, it's now in the process of being somewhat repudiated. New studies coming out that, loss aversion actually isn't a thing. So, we have to be careful about what we think is happening with the customers.
It's evolving, right? I think what you're picking up on, it's a really good point, Andy, is customer behavior is changing. Therefore, the things must evolve.
And I think our understanding is changing. I don't know if their behavior is changing. I think it's, can we understand them better than what we thought we knew before? So the science is evolving, whether people are changing or not. That I would say the science is evolving. People don't evolve that quickly. But one thing I'm always sort of curious about is one thing that's really missing in sales from like a science standpoint is, we've never done wide scale sort of controlled double blind studies of sales. you know, like we would do for new medications or something, to show that, you know, the efficacy of specific actions in certain circumstances, you know, that something, you know, conducted with rigor, because what we have that passes for research today in sales is all self-reported behaviors, not observed behaviors. And we sort of pass those surveys off as science. I'm like, well, that's not science. That's just somebody saying this is what they do.
Yeah, which we know that there's issues with that too. Well, look, the more artistic we make sales, the more job security and the more money we make. The sales has a perverse incentive to not be a science. Sales has a perverse incentive to not be systematized. The second we admit that there's a process, the second that we admit that there's a standardized way, like gap accounting, to actually do sales, that you're right. But again, keep in mind, that's the difference like between a good accountant and a great accountant. And we're not, and when I talk about the science of sales, I'm not talking about great accountants. I'm talking about good accountants. They all follow gap. They all follow the exact same accounting principles. Okay. In sales, we refuse to believe that this could possibly exist when in reality it does. And let me just walk you, I'll just walk you through it very plainly.
Sure.
Here's a sales process for B2B. And my friends, I want you to hit pause after this. And then I want you to go really look through your last 10 deals, close one, close loss, and tell me if this isn't exactly what happened. Okay. Step one, there's two phases, two ways you get in. One is through a decision maker or higher level. One is below. I'll start with the end user. The end user, you get somebody who's somewhat interested. You go through, you do a high level discovery. Oh, wow, Susan, this is interesting. Guess what? Then what do? They get more people on their team. Then you do a broader demo to that broader group. Then the goal is to then get a meeting with their boss to decide if there's budget to be able to move forward. Then you get buy-in from the boss to do some type of proof of concept. And only if it's successful, then we'll move forward to something larger. Then you go back to the end user and you walk them through it. You run a very successful proof of concept over 30 to 60 days and you close the deal. Or you go in through the decision maker. And after the first call, you say, Roger, next steps, I'm going to set up a meeting and a demo with your frontline people, make sure it's something that they love. Then you do a demo with their team. Great, it's something they love. Now you come back to Roger and you talk about budget. And then you move forward into proof of concept and you set clear KPIs for success and you move forward. That is sales. And literally almost every deal, like an accordion, it's a little bit longer. There's more stakeholders if it's enterprise, and it's shorter if it's, you know, you could condense some of those steps as the end user and decision maker in a transactional sale. That is sales. Every time. It's that pattern, right? And I'm talking about software sales but manufacturing. Mm. There's just mutations for other versions of this. But that is, you can boil it down to that in almost every case. There's just mutations of that original like blueprint.
Well, but that's a very sales-centric way to look at it. So, I mean, take the Gartner chart on the buyer journey.
It's how people buy.
Well, but look at how's that aligned though with what, let's say, Gartner put out in their buying journey study that came out 2 years ago, that if you saw their, what they call their spaghetti diagram, with very complex diagram of the buyer's journey, but its core were four jobs that buyers accomplish. Problem identification first.
Yes,
second,
that's a discovery meeting.
Solution exploration, which is identifying exactly the alternatives for how they can. Three, choosing a path to follow. Four, selecting a vendor to follow that path with.
It's identical. It's literally identical. You run a discovery. Here is something next. Conversation number two. Okay, here's exactly how we're going to be able to work with you or help you. Again, where you have the broader group of people that come together. Then maybe behind closed doors, they go and look at a few other vendors. Then you move into some type of proof of concept. Or if it's a bigger product and you don't have it, then there's just more of that joint solutioning and then they buy. It's the same.
Okay.
Do you start at the top or do you start at the bottom? Either way, I need to get these people to love it and make sure that they see utility in it. I need this person to understand the bigger picture, like benefit of this. It's identical.
Go ahead. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I do. Yeah, it's the same.
All right, let's move on to the second myth is that sales is all, the myth is that sales is all about relationship building. So tell me what you mean by that.
Well, the fact that because Pete, you're likable, that we're pals, that we're going to do business together. I think that there's a, you know, and Challenger sale is really the first kind of bombshell to drop on, like, hey, guess what? The relationship builder is not a top persona. But I think in enterprise sales in particular, I think there's an overemphasis on being likable and being cordial and being, you know, polite and, you know, Challenger sale is kind of the first step. But I think as buyers become busier, right, we're more inundated with more information than ever. Now we're moving digital. you know, it's about, you know, and again, it's always been that idea of like a trusted advisor. But I feel like now more than anything is buyers are looking for people who can give them facts, you know, like help me to be smarter. That part is not changed. But it's less about like, do I like Ryan and want to play golf with him as opposed to what's the utility you can provide me and my business?
Yeah. And certainly agree that the day of the lunches and golf and so on, I mean, that to me is not, I know it's what Challenger was talking about. They're talking about relationships, but that's not really a relationship. My virtue of being, you know, if you look at what just the definition of relationship is, you know, the way in which two or more people are connected. If you're dealing with a prospect, you have a relationship with them. It's about functional relationships, relationship of utility. But when I hear people talk about relationship, is like, what is the relationship? You're in a relationship with a person if you're selling to them. You're in a relationship. You're not friends. But why are we trying to tell people it's not important? Because I'll disagree with you on the likability. I think in an absolute sense, do you need to be likable? No. We've all know jerks have gotten orders. But I think it's silly, actually, to tell people they shouldn't try to be likable.
Of course because, you should try to be likable.
Because, but that's sort of what's coming across is it's a myth.
But that's not why they buy. They don't buy because they're likable.
Whoa. How do you know? So let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
On your last deal that you won, what was your margin of victory? How much did you win by? Quantify it. How much did you win by? 1%? 2%?
Are you talking 10%? About how much did, like, compared to the competition?
Yeah, if you won by the competition, even the competition was status quo, staying still, what was your margin of victory?
Why is there a comparison? Well,
but here's the thing is, every little thing adds up. I mean, you don't have to be likable. But, yeah, I believe, and my experience has shown me over 40 plus years, is that you can never know what's going to make a difference. So everything is additive, you know, the sort of aggregation of marginal gains theory, that every little thing is important. So if you have the opportunity to be likable, why wouldn't you?
Of course you should be. I think there's a nitpick on the word. I think when we talk about sales and we talk about relationship building, okay, let's be clear about what we're talking about first, okay? When it comes to relationship building, I think most people, when I say that, what do you think of? They don't think of the relationship equals business impact. They think of the people that rely, and let's be very clear, rely on likability, on palling it up, on being friendly and being cordial, rely on it, that part of the relationship is the crux of the partnership. To your point, of course you want to be likable. Of course you want to do these other things, but it's not why people do business with you. And the point is that it's a myth to think that if I would over-index on being a thought partner to a business as opposed to being a buddy to the decision maker. It's not it's not 0-1 either way. You're right.
But I think we're long past the day where people thought that the relationship in B2B sales entailed the buddy.
Look at big enterprise sales, man. Go talk to your average person, you know, who's sitting behind a desk for the first time and, you know, struggling to know how to sell.
I sold hundreds of millions of dollars of stuff over my career for the first 25 years of my career. I didn't play golf once with a client.
That's you. That's you, Andy.
But it's the people I knew as well. There were some companies that did it. But my point is, 20 years ago, that started dying out.
It's not dead. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, but I just want to give people context. Because I think that, you know, when people talk about this, you know, the myth of the relationship is, and the reason you say nitpick on it, but I think it's not a nitpick. I think it's really important people understand is you have a human relationship with this person you're selling to or the people you're selling to. It doesn't mean they're friends by any stretch of imagination.
But I think the amount.
But the ability to connect at a human level is still paramount in order to be a business advisor, in order to be a thought advisor to them and so on. If you don't have that, if their perception of you is negative off the get-go, they're not going to hear you.
I think you're talking about the difference between relationship and trust. Like, do they have to trust you.
You need that connection to get trust. Isn't trust a relationship?
It depends, right? I could trust you, like the same person that you might trust to do business with, or you might trust the level of trust it takes to watch my kids versus for me to write you a check for $25,000 is night and day.
Absolutely. I use that example. That's why I'm laughing, because I use that example. Is, yeah, I trust at a business level, but I'm not going to have them babysit my kids. But I still have a relationship. And I don't want to go down the rabbit hole on this, but I think words matter. And I think people are confused by this.
Here's
how I phrase it. You have a connection with this person. And this connection is for the purpose of helping them do what they need to do to make a purchase decision. And it requires a certain level of human interaction that includes, it doesn't hurt and it helps you in aggregate to be likable, to be human, to have empathy, to build trust, which are all part of that connection. And that connection could be defined as a relationship, but let's call it a connection because people seem to be so sensitive about this word relationship.
Correct.
Oh, good. Yes. We're in violent agreement. Okay, here we go. On to the next one.
I think it's the word relationship. I think if I can, the word relationship in the context I'm using is, if you think about a scale of 0 to 100, it's the over-reliance on a personal connection versus business partnership. And that's maybe a better way to define it back.
I think the people that took the lead in changing that, starting, I call it 20 years ago roughly, but were the buyers. And yeah, if there's a salesperson still thinks, to your point, that that's how they're going to succeed, then they're not paying attention to the people they're selling to.
I agree.
So, all right. Myth 3, you need an internal champion. So why is this a myth?
And again, I'm going to, knowing where we went with relationship,
Don't presume anything here.
Let me define it, because you're talking, this is a 5-word soundbite from LinkedIn, right? So
right.
I think it's important to give some context. The point of this is reliance. And I think what I see and observe is that there's a lot of sales methodologies and processes that say, step 2, who's our champion in this? Mm-hmm. And what I've seen historically in my career is that when you have a true champion, it is awesome. I mean, but guess what? The times that you get that person who literally, it's like once every few years, right? They take you through the process, they tear down. What it is is don't rely on other people to do the job for you. And what I mean, and the most common part that this comes up, Andy, is when you put together the plan, you put together the plans for partnership, and then you hand over the keys to some person versus you being multi-threaded within that organization to where you've got people who are advocates. Don't get me wrong. That's good. You need advocates at each level and each in different departments. But thinking that a champion is going to get the deal done for you and articulate the partnership is a fallacy. And instead of the amount of sellers I see that try to sell through this champion, right? Versus knowing, look, it's my job to get in front of these people versus hand over the keys. So therefore I need to build relationships throughout this at all levels versus expecting my champion to take me to these people. It's the proactiveness that I'm highlighting there.
You said you needed to build what throughout?
Relationships, okay. By my definition, not the common definition.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
I know.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on this one. It's funny you said reliance, because that's the way I had written in my notes here. I said, well, yeah, a better way to phrase that is you can't rely on there being an internal champion, nor should you. And absolutely right. So you need, as you said, you need those acumen, you need those skills that enable you to drive the decision forward.
Yeah. And I'm not going to rest. I think that's it. I'm not going to rest on the fact that I've got an okay thing here. I'm going to go out and make it happen. I'm going to go get those I'm not going to, just if I don't get the relationship, I don't. And again, I'm talking, about larger, deals. And I feel like that's where so many reps fall short.
Well, and I think what they do, with this idea, and I think this sort of started with the idea of this, you know, research about more stakeholders being involved in a decision. Therefore, yeah. There's a mobilizer, but it sort of, you know, defeats this idea of an internal champion is that you still need to go find the person or the people who have the most at stake with the decision, who care most about the outcome, be affected by the outcome. And yeah, they may not have the power to be an internal champion, but they will be the advocate, as you talk about. And you need advocates.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree with you 100% on that one. Okay. Myth 4. If it's not directly generating leads and conversions, it's not worth my time. So we're going to spend some time on this one.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So tell us what you mean by that.
Oh, man.
I'm with you on this one. So
where I don't know where it started. No. I'm not. I don't know where it started. Well, maybe predictable revenue. And I love Aaron. And Aaron and I actually caught up last night. And I've got it. But I really feel like it was right until it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And obviously he's written follow-on books as well too.
Sure.
But what happened is what we started to simplify sales to, if you get X widgets, it equals Y whatevers to Z whatevers to X deals.
Yeah.
And
math.
And that just math. It was math because, and I think this is the variable. If you're a marketer, sales leader, I really want you to pay attention to this. It was okay to look at it that way when the activities, the first component, the very first thing was a one-to-one, not interaction, when that correlated to a sale. What do I mean by that? When an activity, every email, every call, every inbound lead was someone who you were trying to set a meeting with,
right,
or came in expressing interest.
Right.
If every activity, but guess what today? We're asking sales reps to post on LinkedIn. We're asking sales reps to send videos. We're asking reps to do things that either can or can't be tracked. And we're compensating. So that's problem one. And you know, before I go in, I'm going to go into the comp as the other part of this problem.
Sure.
But that's one. And let's sit, and we can sit here and talk about this. Is that it used to be like that. But now we're the outbound efforts, and I'll talk about outbound in particular. Mm-hmm. The same goes for inbound. People that think let's go back to 2010. How many people were producing ebooks? Not as many. So guess what? When someone downloaded it, maybe they had a higher intent. Now, yeah, every day there's 2 million blog posts published. How many ebooks? I don't know, 10,000, 5,000? I don't know. And so the intent of humans has now changed so wildly that the one-to-one-to-one of activities versus outcomes as a predictor of sales is gone.
Right.
And we've got to move away from purely tracking and thinking that if we just hammer the more button, that it's going to put out more sales because the equation's broke.
Which is still the primary MO for
more
most SaaS companies. Yes.
More. I can't tell you. I mean, how many SDR teams? I was talking to an SDR. I won't mention the company, but you know, they were doing a blitz at the end of the month. And they're rewarding because, you know, Susan made, you know, 700 activities. Yay, Susan. Mm-hmm. She hated her job. She didn't
life.
Still finished second, you know, and like, man, what happened to being clever? God, like, you know, it's right. So we're pushing all of our clients to measure first outcome, which we call like a meaningful conversation or interaction. Mm-hmm. And you can define it however you want. It could be you're in the process of booking a meeting, someone directs you to the right person. There's a bunch of different ways, and really it depends on your business, but start tracking that instead of and then that to meetings ran, then you get back to that one-to-one and then the equation becomes smooth again. But well, I want to encourage teams to be creative.
Yes.
Too.
You know, I was going to say, just a simple illustration I used for that is, you know, someone said, oh, somebody's making 50 calls a day. So, you know, they're being productive, or if they make 55, they've increased their productivity. And I'm like, well, if you had a factory that was building a widget and you built 100 widgets an hour, but 50 of them had to be thrown away because they didn't work, is your productivity 100 widgets an hour or 50? And it's like, same with our leads. Is, you know, why are we measuring, to your point, I think, as leads if they don't have a productive outcome?
There you go. Now that goes to the second part. Yeah. Marketing is compensation. Marketing is being compensated. on MQLs and SQLs. Mm-hmm. So guess what that incentivizes? Jam it through. If marketing's main compensation, and by the way, this is not marketing's fault either. Sales, so by no means am I saying that. I do think that marketing and sales should both be tied to revenue. But marketing has been, so this goes back to my whole point. Marketing has been told, throw out brand, throw out PR, throw out, you know, all the things that made that that were the other side of the coin. And it's so funny. I tell this story too because I was a hardcore kind of like sales leader by the MQLs until like mid 2018, until like literally. And I'm like, if April 2018 Jake heard this, Jake, he'd like punch him in the face. He'd be like, dude, brand, that's the arts and crafts. But now look, I've done it for my business. We're closing millions of dollars of organic LinkedIn ads, spending zero.
Right.
You know, and I think B2B is boring, dude, boring. And I think brand is ready for a comeback. And so that goes back to what you can't measure does matter. And I think the answer is both, that we need to change marketing's incentives to be aligned. We need to change SDR incentives to be aligned with sales. We need to change sales attitudes about if it's not perfectly wrapped up in a bow. Like, dude, that's your job. Create.
Exactly.
Man, I used to, I mean, maybe you're familiar with the term create the need. Guess what? Yeah. If it was called information giving, I'd slash your salary by 66%, you know? And so we've got to have kind of a reckoning here of like common sense and getting these organizations between marketing, sales development, and sales aligned around the common goal, which is revenue, and really treating these groups how to work together. And that does start at the top, and it starts with compensation, that if each group is compensated for just their one part of the widget, it's the same reason you have friction between sales and customer success. Salesperson doesn't care. They're jamming the deal through. Mm-hmm. Somebody churns, who cares? I got my commission. We're trying to push our clients to where a rep gets 80% of their commission on deal close, 20% on power usage. Mm-hmm. I think every single sales organization that has a handoff model should use that. Like immediately, it will increase the quality of your deals if you change that reps get compensated a component of their commission when the person actually uses it.
Yeah,
so there's all these disincentives.
Have a longer tail for the AE, absolutely.
Something in there. And it's not all of it. Yes, of course, all of it, most of it should be when the deal closes. But just think about all those silos I just mentioned. And again, now go back to, we were talking about the customer. So we're going on like a different track now, but just think about what I said. So there's all these things that people should be doing, but they're not because you can't track it. And their boss says, if I can't track it, it doesn't matter. Building brand as a marketer, being creative as an SDR, you know, like, working maybe deals that I shouldn't as a salesperson because hell, who knows, even though it doesn't fit the criteria, let's roll the dice. And oh my gosh, what do you know? It turned into an $85,000 deal. So,
Don't you think part of the reason this is happening is just as you said, and I'll put another spin on it, is that because they're doing all these things that they shouldn't be doing, but they can, right? Because the technology now enables us, we'll make these calls, we'll send these emails, we'll do this you know, sort of mindless activity that you're referring to earlier, because we can, and then it drains us of the ability to do something that's creative. Because I think is that too many sales leaders sort of operate from a position of fear. I know what my numbers are. I know what the metrics are. I can generate this. This is predictable for me. But they don't think about how I could do it better. Yeah. So instead, they get protective of what their position.
There's two parts there, because when we can get into this always optimizing, which is a whole other kind of post, like COVID, what COVID made us realize. But I want to go back to it. What I feel like is happening, and maybe you agree, is our windows as sales leaders is we are continuing to look less and less and less at the mid and long term. Mm-hmm. We're more and more scared. Whereas as a sales leader, you know, I did a webinar yesterday where we talked to a marketing leader about this. It's 80-20. 80% of my time is dedicated to the now, the month, quarter. 20% of my time is dedicated to the year and next year. And if you aren't doing that as a leader, then you're always on the defense. I call it being on the defense, you know, block, as opposed to the offense. I want to show up to December and I'm executing the plan that we laid out and adjusted from September or from better yet, July. And so I feel like leaders are, like you said, they feel that pressure and aren't playing the long game. They're not, or even the mid game, to realize, you know, man, what if I did let my SDRs connect with every single person in their patch on LinkedIn? And then I had them comment and like on their post before I sent an email.
Shocking.
But I can't track it. I can't track comments and likes.
So I'm going to scourge that. which they do. They actively discourage that happening.
Exactly. I mean, Even though it's common sense, you know that that's smarter. There's nobody you can tell me, like, it's not better for Andy to be like, oh, wait, who's this person? Because guess what? Most people get zero comments on their posts because they're just resharing people's posts. If your SDR goes in comments once one week, once the next week, that person remembers your person. You can't tell me that's not better than a cold call saying, like, you've never heard of me.
Absolutely.
Well, so there are things that you can't measure that matter. That is where that comes from.
Well, but a lot of that comes from sort of our digital marketing era. Yeah, I can't tell how many marketers I've talked to. Well, we can't do that because I can't measure it. It's like,
because I get comped on MQLs.
Yeah.
I get comped on MQLs and SQLs, Andy. Right. Why do I care?
Why do I care about brand?
Well, exactly. Why do I care about brand? And it's the same reason why marketing stopped helping sales like it used to and stopped supporting growth in current customers. Because they don't get compensated when a current customer upsells. They don't get compensated when a deal gets put. Well, maybe they get a small, but they're not, you know, hey, so that activity of, you know, investing in my sales enablement team of, you know, creating more content. What's the ROI of creating five variations of my case studies that are based on micro verticals that's going to help my team increase their close rate right in the now? In the long term, it's the right play and it's going to make you more money, but I'm under the gun today.
Yeah. And that to your point, precisely, drives so much activity, quote unquote, if you will, on the part of marketing is to be able to hit that number. All right. So last one, and unfortunately, hopefully we have enough time to fit this in, is myth five, organic social traffic is worthless. So you sort of touched on this before, but let's dive into this one because this is an important one as well.
Yeah. I mean, just look at B2B. I mean, right? Nine times, I would say, my guess is 90%+ of marketers schedule posts on a Friday or for the month in advance, and they just post and they wonder why there's no ROI.
No engagement.
And guess what? And by the way, when social media first came to rise, and this is for my B2B friends, it was a waste of time. LinkedIn wasn't a social platform where people went to for news or information. Mm-hmm. LinkedIn was a job space. But guess what? My friends, life's changed. And dramatically changed in the last 2 or 3 years, especially since 2018. So the last 2 years in particular, LinkedIn has become a content site. Well, you're a B2B marketer, but because again, it goes back to what you can measure. Why do I like performance ads and ads? I measure it. I got X impressions to X clicks to X leads to X MQLs to blah, blah, blah. Whereas how do I measure the value of a view or a like or a comment? Well, I don't know, right? Right. Well, and so
back to the day of measuring eyeballs. Yeah.
You know, and there's something to it, right? Of course, I'm not just advocating for, you know, you just do that. But I think there's a couple issues with organic right now. One is most marketers have it just wrong. And what I mean by that is that when you're posting, I'm just going to focus on LinkedIn, most of my B2B community. I think that's where you should be spending most of your time focused. Mm-hmm. I think there's applications 300%. On all platforms, but I'll just talk about LinkedIn one. The first thing is, don't look at LinkedIn and your page there as a lead generation or traffic generator. It's a massive mistake that if you think that you're going to drive traffic to your blogs by posting it on LinkedIn, you know, the biggest trick I can give you, I'm going to give you one thing, and it's the dumbest thing. You want to triple your engagement on a post, post the exact same thing, but put the link in the comments. Why? Because LinkedIn algorithm hates you to send people off site. Marketers, why don't you know that? Why don't you know that?
And that's not new. That's not new.
No. But how many posts have, like, it makes no, because guess what? You can't do that in Hootsuite, Andy. In Hootsuite, I can't auto-comment.
People still use Hootsuite?
You know, it's whatever. Hard. I don't care what you're using. Hootsuite, Hey Orc, I don't care. The point is, it's not automated. We're looking, like there are things, and I'm telling, like, you know, look at, like, what does LinkedIn like? LinkedIn likes text only posts. I don't know. It's just what it likes. God, marketers, this is great. Your content people can be creative and they can riff and they can rip apart one of your eBooks and make some commentary on it. I am telling you, and I'll just, these are the facts. Okay. 2018 May, Jake Dunlap scaled. We released the most amazing eBook in my opinion on GDPR. We summarized, like, if you're a marketing or sales leader, here's what you need to know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we release it on social. It does okay. And I'm like, oh my gosh, we're putting out a blog post every week. Why are we doing this? I said, you know what? This is not how consumers want to consume on LinkedIn. They want nuggets. They want little bite size. And then guess what? For a year, we didn't post one ebook or blog post. And I started posting on LinkedIn every single day.
Yep.
That year, we generated probably close to 700,000. Last year, I mean, direct attribution to I found you on LinkedIn, I think we did 1.5 million. And we're a small consulting firm.
Right.
We closed one six-figure, it's now a six-figure deal. We closed two six-figure deals, right? In the last, probably like 10 months or so, because I'm going with the extreme use cases.
Sure.
Where the very first call was, I don't even know what you do. I swear to God. I don't even know what you do, but I think we need help. Mm-hmm. That's how it started. It wasn't because I educated them on an ebook and all of our product set. I'm adding value, adding value, adding value. That is the game. You give, 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 and then you toss out a like. And guess what? Whenever I ask for something, because I only do it 1 in 8 or 10 posts, guess what my response rate does? Boop.
Yep.
And so we've got to realize that social is about give, not about come download, come click, and therefore you build brand equity that will generate real revenue that you can go back and attribute to that source, but I can't tell you that one LinkedIn post equaled $1. I don't know. That's what I can't tell you.
But expanding this to B2B sellers is they need to be posting on LinkedIn. Oh, this is part of their brand building. And you know, it frustrates me no end when to your point, you know, you talk to VPs of sales, you know, CROs, CMOs, and they actively discourage their sellers from doing it because they think it's a waste of time.
Yep.
And you look at the companies who are doing it well, and there's this additive effect, not only just to the individual, but to the company as well.
Exactly.
And yeah, I'll tell people, and this is, I wouldn't hire an AE right now if they weren't active on LinkedIn.
Yeah. And to your point, coupled with also having the numbers, to me, it's going to be table stakes. Think about this. If I was an SDR, I would destroy everybody. I already know it. All I would do is cold calls and LinkedIn. I would go like, comment, and then I would call you and say, hey, Andy, look, you popped up in my feed a couple of times. This thing's really resonated. Based on that, here's what we're doing here. Is it okay if I send you some details? If it makes sense, we can set up time. Does that work? Boom. Yeah.
Boom.
Human connection with a comment, human connection with a voice. Going back to your point, the human is the main thing left in sales, right? But again, I'm talking about, but then I saw something that was business value, etc. So right. I feel like but guess what? As an SDR, I had to give this advice. I said, look, wake up early in the morning at 7:30 a.m. Make all your fake ass cold calls. Sorry, Andy, you might have to bleep that. And then just go do what you should actually be doing. Like that's my advice to most SDRs. Whatever the dumb metrics your boss gives, go do that in the morning. Bing, 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 bing. And then just go put your common sense cap on and go to work.
That's great advice. Great advice.
Oh man. Use Ring DNA to make your No, I'm kidding.
Absolutely.
Of course. That's the must.
They've already heard the ad so far, but now.
Yeah, exactly.
There may be two ads by this point in the episode. So
I love it. And Andy, I want to thank you, man. Let me tell you real quick, because I know we're wrapping up.
Yeah.
I want to thank you for the conversation on the relationship. I get on so many of these podcasts and it's just this, you know, like, oh yeah, Jacob, this is good. This is the stuff people need to hear, because when people go out and pontificate and you can't have a dialogue about it, that's a problem. And that's a problem on LinkedIn right now, is that it's all a bunch of violent agreement and not enough discourse. And discourse is healthy, because there's people out there that are listening. And because of the way that we went back and forth, they're like, oh, so relationships are good, because I really like the way that you defined it, you know, and it kind of, okay, oh, you know, next time I'm going to put a little tweak on the way that I describe it. But Andy, I really appreciated it. And I want you to know that it's important that we talk about these things and we have discourse, so things we change and we get better.
Well, I agree 100%. And I appreciate the fact that you are so thoughtful about it. You know, I follow you on LinkedIn. There's not many people. Well, as you said, people are pontificating without thinking about it. And you've actually put the time and effort clearly into thinking about it. And that's what we need. We need more voices like that in sales, because it's going to change. And let's drive the change.
I appreciate it.
Jake, been a pleasure. If people want to contact you, how can they get hold of you?
LinkedIn is, as you know, probably a good place.
I didn't have to say that.
Type in Jake Dunlap on the first thing. The other thing is, look, we've invested a lot in YouTube. So just type in Jake Dunlap Sales. And then look, if there's something that registered here, you know, look, it scaled. We are focused on helping organizations to optimize and standardize, you know, best practices, and keep that always optimizing mindset. We've started to hint at it, but mm-hmm. that's such a critical thing that I think that we do differently than other consulting firms is we're focused on modern optimizing. And so hit me up, jake@scaled.com. But again, if you're interested in the content, go to YouTube, go to LinkedIn. I put out everything that I know in my brain. You know, look, candidly, 99% of people, you don't even need to hire Scale. Just go, if you can piece together, if you have a question, you can piece together the same solution. But no, I appreciate it, Andy, and that's where to find me.
All right, great, Jake. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. I'm ever so grateful for your support of this show. And I want to thank my guest, Jake Dunlap, for putting up with me and for sharing his insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you could also leave us a rating or a review, let us know how we're doing. Well, we'd certainly appreciate it. You can do all that on your phone in less than a minute as soon as this episode is over. So thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.